It's an American AM. I'm your host, Henry Raines. With me in the broadcast studio, Jim Delgado. I want to quickly remind you of our websites, AmericanAM.com. You can get headlines from alternative and mainstream news sources, links to the websites of past, present, future guests. You can listen live at AmericanAM.com. Our archives are available on demand at AmericanAM.podomatic.com. AmericanAM.podomatic.com. And we want to thank you. Yesterday we were all the way up to number 2 in the news and political category on Podomatic.com. We want to thank you for your support on that. Send your email comments to show@AmericanAM.com. Our next guest, Camilo Mejia, is the author of Road from Aramati, The Private Rebellion of Staff Sergeant Camilo Mejia. He's a former staff sergeant with the U.S. Army, applied for discharge in 2004 as a conscientious objector and was sentenced to prison for desertion. The book will tell you his personal story, but he's here with us today to help us out on that. It's published by the New Press, and you can find out more about the book itself and ordering at thenewpress.com. That link's on our guest page at AmericanAM.com. Camilo Mejia, thank you for joining us on American AM. And also, am I pronouncing your name right?
Yes, actually, you are. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, let's start before your experience in Iraq. This is, as they say, an all-volunteer army, although there seems to be an economic draft of sorts out there. How did you become enlisted in the Army?
Well, at the time, I was 19 years old, and I had come from Costa Rica, which is my mom's country. I was born in Nicaragua, but I was raised in 3 countries, Nicaragua, the U.S., and Costa Rica. And at the time, I had just graduated high school. I had gone to a community college for 2 semesters, but I didn't really have a sense of belonging anywhere because I had been moving around for so long. And my financial aid was cut out because I was working at a Burger King making minimum wage. So they said that basically I could pay for my own tuition. So at the time, you know, being so young and not having any real prospects in life and, you know, not being able to go to school and not having that sense of belonging, the Army seemed to offer all those things. So I just, you know, instead of going back to school, I joined the Army, the infantry.
What year was that?
This was 95.
Okay. And so you became a staff sergeant, so it must have worked well for you for a while. You must have flourished in the Army there.
Eventually I did. I mean, you have to remember I was in 8 years or close to 8 years before being deployed to the Middle East. So by then, you know, if you've basically done your job, you know, you're going to get promoted regardless unless you do something bad.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Before you got deployed, what were some of your duties?
Well, I was an infantryman the entire time. So from the time I got promoted to corporal through sergeant and staff sergeant, I basically I was on and off of an infantry squad leader, which means that, you know, you're put in charge of an 8-man team, 9 including yourself, and you learn maneuverings, you know, for combat. You learn first aid procedures. You learn just basically the art of war, I guess you would call it.
And I know you were only 19 when you joined, but it was shortly after the first Gulf War, so I imagine you were aware that combat was a possibility. What before you actually experienced it, what was your thoughts of what combat would be like, what a war would be like?
Well, you get different notions of war depending on, you know, how you approach the subject. You know, if you approach it from a combat perspective, based on the training, you know, to me, combat was going to be something like what happened in Vietnam because we did a lot of jungle training. So my idea of combat was very similar to watching like the movie Platoon or something like that because of our training. But if you looked at the Gulf War, then it's a whole different ball game. You know, you're looking at, you know, warfare in the desert, and going into Iraq, that's what I thought it would be like. You know, to there's going to be something like Desert Storm. But it was actually very different. It was neither one. When we got there, it was mostly urban. We were not in the desert. We were not fighting the war with a conventional military. But, you know, we were out there in the streets and alleyways of places like Ramadi and Haditha and Baghdad. And, you know, that's basically where the war is taking place, you know, in the streets and by the schools and the mosques and the alleyways.
We're speaking with Camilo Mejia. His book is Road from Our Ramadi, The Private Rebellion of Staff Sergeant Camilo Mejia. And one more personal item that I find very interesting here before we get to what you experienced in Iraq is you are raised by prominent Sandinista revolutionaries. Also, it says you draw inspiration from Jesuit teachings. Were you very politically conscious coming from that background before, in your early teens, young man?
Not really, because after the Sandinistas took power from the dictatorship of Somoza, both of my parents were very well situated in the new government, and we lived with a lot of privilege. So I never really had to question where things came from. You know, I went to the best schools. I went to this private Catholic school where I got my Jesuit teachings. And no, I wasn't raised with a conscience. You know, the stuff was part of my background and part of my history and my life, but it didn't really play a role in any of my decision-making processes until I was deployed to Iraq and started experiencing war there. You know, it became like a catalyst, and it brought back a lot of memories, and it triggered a lot of analysis, I guess.
Why did your parents leave?
My parents didn't. My mom left because my grandmother, she's an American citizen. She's been living here forever. And my dad stayed in Nicaragua, though. And then initially we went back to Costa Rica to live there for some time. And then, you know, my mom wanted to be with her family, so we came here.
Okay. And what were their reactions, your mom's reaction, when you told her you were going to join the military?
Well, you know, you would think that it would be more of a political reaction, you know, saying, you know, how dare you, you know, disgrace the revolutionary family name or something like that. But it wasn't anything like that. It was more like a regular parent's reaction to their kids joining the military. You know, she was afraid of wars, and, you know, she didn't think that there was a real match between my personality and being a soldier, and she was completely against it.
Okay.
And my dad was too, you know, both of them. But particularly my mom was really against my joining the military. She thought I had, you know, I had always been into drama and poetry and literature. And, you know, she thought I was crazy to leave that to join, you know, a career in the military.
And so when were you deployed to Iraq?
Well, we first deployed to Jordan, and this was in the beginning of March, March 6th, actually, of 2003. And we spent about 2 months there. And then at the end of April of that same year, we went to Baghdad.
Okay, so you were in Iraq very shortly after the initial invasion.
Yeah, the president hadn't even said, called it, you know, end of major combat operations when we were there. He actually called it like a few days after we arrived.
So,
but that was actually not even the beginning of the resistance. You know, that was just like, you know, when they took the regular army unit, and you know, which didn't really put up a fight, a real fight. You know, the real action began once the resistance got organized.
Okay, so what were your first experiences there once you got into the hostile territory?
Well, the first experiences that we had there were not really all that violent, but they were pretty intense. The first mission that we had was to run a POW camp, a prisoner of war camp. And there, our job basically was to keep people in sleep deprivation, you know, detainees. And we did that by conducting all kinds of fear tactics that amount to torture, you know, like performing mock executions and, you know, hitting walls with hammers to create.
Camilo, let's go a little slowly through this, because this has been an ongoing topic on the program about whether, you know, what some people call torture and what some people don't. And I'd like you to be more specific. A mock execution, how did that happen? How did that work?
Well, we had these detainees in these huge bunkers, you know, these fighter jet bunkers. in a place called Al-Asad. And because of the type of structure that it is, the concrete structure, you know, there's a lot of echo inside. So you go in this thing, it's like basically like a huge concrete shell on the ground, and has an opening at the front. And you go in, and you find this place where, you know, it's basically circled with concertina wire, and there are people inside who are hooded and restrained in their hands with plastic ties. The hoods are sandbags, basically, and they've been awake for 3 days. And you get there, and, you know, your job is to basically take over and keep running the operation, and they tell you, well, you know, this is how you do it, and then you tell them to get up, and you tell them to get down, and you basically keep them moving constantly to make sure that they're awake and to make sure that they're obeying you. And then when they won't listen to you, you grab a huge sledgehammer, and then you hit the wall next to them. And because of the echo and because of the type of structure that I explained this was, when you hit the wall with the sledgehammer, it sounded like an explosion, so that scared them into obedience. And then when that didn't work, you would grab a pistol and then put it to their heads through the sandbag or the hood, and then you would charge it without actually putting a round in it, but making the motion and the sound of, you know, charging the pistol. And so as to make them believe that they're about to be executed. And, you know, you let them sleep for 30 seconds after that, you know, to destroy any remaining notion of time and space and how long they've been awake. And that's basically how you do it. And that's how you basically, quote-unquote, soften them up for interrogation.
And now, how many people were in this situation, the detainees? How many detainees were in that situation?
Well, there were different categories. I think the detainees that we were keeping on sleep deprivation were about maybe 8 or 10. I don't recall that well. But there were more who were not considered enemy combatants, who were not hooded, and who were right there next to this guy. And then there was another area where they had people who were sick. And there was yet another chamber where, like, whenever, you know, the tactics didn't work with the detainees, you know, the mock execution and the noise and all of that, they had this chamber where you could put one human being, you know, and he would stand because it was too narrow to sit or lay down. And then you would, like, hit the wall next to the detainee to basically drive him insane as punishment for not obeying. So there were different categories there. It must have had about, I don't know, maybe 20 people or something like that.
And this is over what period of time that you would be dealing with these people?
The people, the actual sleep deprivation, we only did it for about a day maybe, because they would get recycled. So, like, this was not an interrogation site. The interrogation that took place where we were was basically to find out the circumstances under which they were captured, what tribe they belong to, where they came from, all of these initial questions. And then every so often, you know, a team of military police officers would show up at the site and then pick them up and then take them to a more permanent, you know, interrogation site. So we only kept them for about 24 hours, but we kept the other ones for about maybe 5 days. It was a very short mission for us.
And under whose authority were you told to do this?
Well, that's a very interesting question. The people who are actually running this place are known as spooks in the military. Spook is someone who, they basically don't wear uniforms. You don't know if they're in the military. You don't know if they're in the CIA or some type of, you know, contracting company. They're basically untraceable. They don't use their real names. They don't have unit badges or anything like that. And they're highly trained. They're highly trained in interrogation or linguistics or counterinsurgency tactics. And they were basically the ones who were running the show. So units would show up there, and then they would train them, and they would tell them, this is how you sleep deprive people and how you get them to soften up to be interrogated. And once they do that, the people who were trained by them will train their relief. So when we got there, we were trained by a scout unit. We were an infantry unit. But that scout unit had been trained by the spooks, you know, who were basically in charge, but who are untraceable. So no accountability there.
The book is Road from Al-Ramadi, The Private Rebellion of Staff Sergeant Camilo Mejia. We're speaking with him right now. The book is from the New Press. You can find out more about it at thenewpress.com. Jim Delgado is in the studio with me. Jim. Jim Camilo, good morning. How are you doing?
Good morning, Jim.
First of all, I want to tell you, I've read some of the stuff on you, and I admire the fact that you were willing to take on the Army. I was in the military. I'll be honest with you, I would not have the guts to do this. My question is, though, what was the feeling among, the other guys, some of your fellow soldiers? I see that it hurt you. What were they going through? Were they going the same thing you were going through?
Well, they were going through similar things, I think. But you know, I mean, it's there's a subculture of fear and silence and complacency in the military. Right. So there isn't really, at least in the beginning of the occupation, there wasn't really a whole lot of discussion about how we felt or, you know, what we thought about the war. And, you know, there was no political discussion whatsoever. But there was a lot of disaffection in terms of there not being a clear mission. There was a lot of disaffection in terms of the equipment that we had. You know, we were an infantry unit, and we had to exchange magazines with the companies that were not going out on patrol because we didn't have enough ammo to go out. We didn't have a full combat load of bullets. We had to suspend patrols at one point between the hours of 11 in the morning and 6 in the afternoon because we were going out there with 50 pounds of equipment on our bodies, and the temperature was up to 130, 140 degrees. And, you know, like I said, we didn't have water. We didn't have, armor plates for our vehicles. We were lining the walls of our vehicles with old flak vests, you know, from the Vietnam era, and, you know, using sandbags on the floors of our vehicle so that if an IED went off, we wouldn't get totally messed up by it. And, you know, this is at a time when the war was costing up to $1 billion a week, and, you know, we were just wondering, you know, where is all this money going to? Because it's certainly not coming to us. So there was a lot of disaffection. It wasn't just like in terms of what we were doing, you know, to Iraq, but also, you know, how we were being treated as the military, the U.S. military.
And you're talking about treated by the own our administration or by the people that were there?
Hello?
Yeah, you said that the way you were being treated by who? By the administration? By us or by them?
Okay, I'm having a real hard time hearing you now.
All right, well, let's just hold on for a second. We have a caller standing by that wants to ask you a question. I think this is Nick, isn't it?
Yes, Henry, thank you for the time and a great guest, sir. Thank you for your service. Hey, the president and his press secretaries have said that our interrogation techniques are classified. Are you disseminating classified information? How do you protect yourself from the feds?
Could you hear that?
No, it's not classified information. Actually, you know, we've seen worse things in the news. You know, Abu Ghraib was much worse than what happened in Al-Assad with us. And we also had a court-martial, you know, where we brought all of these things out and, you know, we tried to get the military to investigate, but they basically did not. And this is all stuff that you can find on my record of trial, you know. So if you go to Fort Stewart, Georgia, and then you ask for the case of Staff Sergeant Mejia against the U.S. Army, you can get all this stuff. So it's public information, not to mention it's been published by the New Press in my book. And we had attorneys who contacted the Department of the Army to make sure that, you know, we were safe. So it's all open and public information.
All right. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you for your time.
All right. Well, let's move forward a little bit. So how long did you continue at this before you were had a different mission, a different location to operate out of?
Right. So what happened then after that mission, we went to this place called Haditha, which later became infamous in the news because of the massacre that took place there. It was a pretty mellow time when we were there. And then from there, we went to this place called Ramadi, which is where my book draws its title. And Ramadi is a Sunni majority town. And, you know, we got there, and in the beginning, people were skeptical of us. You know, there was not much of an insurgency and, you know, but soon enough, you know, we started getting attacked and responding, and by the way that we were doing things out there, you know, we were infuriating the people, and we were instigating more firefights, and, you know, it got to a point where it got just out of control. You know, we were going out there, and, you know, the majority of the people who were getting killed were civilians, and, you know, we were just basically going out of our way to instigate these firefights and to expose ourselves unnecessarily. So that led to a lot of rumbling against our leadership, and, you know, a lot of disaffection again, and, you know, the beginnings of what you would called fratricide, and I mean, nothing like that happened, but, you know, there were threats to our leadership because of, you know, the missions that we were going out and how we were conducting ourselves.
But when you talk about instigating firefights, what do you mean?
Well, like, for instance, you know, you're not supposed to conduct combat missions by a mosque. And we're doing exactly that. You're not supposed to conduct missions by schools. And we were doing exactly that. You know, you're not supposed to conduct missions by hospitals. And we were doing that. You're not supposed to stay in one place too long because you give the enemy a time to prepare and carry out a deliberate attack on you. And we were doing exactly that. You're not supposed to make yourself predictable. And we were making ourselves very predictable. So it became clear after a while that we were, you know, being used as bait by our leadership, because you had infantry officers who have been in the military for close to 25 years and had no combat experience. So it was in their best interest to use everything within their power, even if it meant, you know, going against our training, to instigate this firefight so that when we got home, they could say, yeah, and we were attacked by the enemy this many times. We killed this many people. We had this many wounded. We arrested so many people. We were crucial to the mission. So a lot of the stuff was, you know, fabricated. You know, a lot of it was just basically us going out there and making people mad and doing the opposite from what we should be doing as an infantry unit.
And at this point, how long had you been in Iraq when you were in Ramadi?
Well, we got to Iraq at the end of April, and we got to Ramadi, like, maybe in the first half of May.
Okay. How long were you in Iraq before you started to consider becoming a conscientious objector?
You know what? I didn't decide to become a conscientious objector until after I left Iraq, when I came home.
So how long
and
was
I
your
really didn't think I could be a conscientious objector in the beginning. It took some time for me to accept that, because I had been to combat, and, you know, I had fired my weapon and been firefights, and we had killed a lot of people.
Okay.
So I felt like I was marked. You know, I felt like it was too late for me to be a conscientious objector.
So how long was your tour?
It was supposed to be a year, but I came back 7 months after we deployed, and then I didn't return. As you know,
okay.
I refused to go back.
And so why did you come back at the seven-month mark?
Because the Department of the Army approved this two-week R&R program for boots on the ground. For anybody who was on the ground for a year, they approved two-week furloughs halfway in between.
So then to get this straight, then you fulfilled your duties, and you just didn't want to go back. So it's different, you know, because a lot of people are going to portray you as this. I mean, I'm sure you've heard it, you know, yellow, you're scared, you volunteer mm-hmm. for the Army. I mean, I know you've been hit with a lot of negativity.
Well, you'd be surprised, but actually it hasn't really been that negative, particularly coming from the military, because I speak about a lot of things. Even people who disagree with my political views, you know, they agree that, you know, it's very hypocritical of the government to say support the troops, you know, when you have the troops out there, you know, going to combat missions without water and without radio equipment and without bulletproof vests and without armored vehicles
right.
and things like that. So they relate to a lot of the stuff that I say, even if they disagree with me politically, so the reaction from people, particularly from the military, has not been really all that bad.
And I'm sure you're not alone, Camilo. About how many people are you organized? Do you have a? Is there a bunch of?
I can't hear you.
Let me turn your mic up a little bit, Mike.
Okay. Are you? You're not alone in this, are you?
No. There are over 10,000 people who have not gone back to Iraq today.
Wow.
Or that's at least more. This is a number from last year.
From last year.
We got Camilo Mejia with us for just a few more minutes. We'll take a couple phone calls at 941-745-1490, 941-745-1490. Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you for being a guest on the show. And I can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, thank you. Can you tell me what you did for your recovery or for your therapy and how you dealt with this and what kind of support you got? And are you still getting support for that? And are you still in, like, the recovery process from this?
Yeah, well, I think that one thing that really helped me, I haven't received any type of, like, professional help from a psychologist or a psychiatrist or anything like that. But I think something that really helped me was that I felt like I was doing something wrong the whole time I was in Iraq. even before I participated in the abuse of prisoners and the killing of civilians, you know, politically I have been against the war. And halfway through my tour, I decided that I would not continue to be a part of that, and I basically rebelled against what I thought was something wrong. And I think that that has gone a long way in my healing process, because I think that a lot of people who felt the same way that I felt and yet continued to follow their orders now feel a lot of anger inside because they did nothing to stop it. They did nothing to change their situation. So I think that the fact that I decided not to go back and that I decided to speak out against what was happening went a long way in my recovery. And also because I joined this organization called Iraq Veterans Against the War, and people can find out about Iraq Veterans Against the War at IVAW.org. And it's basically an organization made up of people, most of whom have been to Iraq or Afghanistan or both, who are, you know, standing up against the war. And so I have, like, the same type of camaraderie that I had in the military, the same type of environment, only, you know, for a different purpose, and that is to, you know, to end the war and bring our troops home and also to pay reparations to the Iraqi people.
So, well, I think you're very brave, and I have a lot of respect for you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right.
Camilo, we're going to have to try and wrap this up. So you came back to the U.S. and decided you weren't going back. Take us through the rest of your story there.
From when the time when I came back?
Yeah, when you decided, when you were wondering if you could be a conscientious objector, when you decided you didn't want to go back.
Well, what happened was that I sought civilian counsel because I knew that for speaking out, the military was not my friend. And I started working on putting together a case with a civilian attorney, himself a resistor from the Vietnam War. And I started looking into the conscientious objector claim, and I started writing the application. I started realizing that I indeed was a conscientious objector. And but at the same time, I was really afraid to speak out publicly because there were no known public combat veterans speaking against the war, particularly who were still in the military. So I was really afraid of what would happen to me. I was really afraid of the reaction from my peers. In the military, I didn't want to be called a traitor or be seen as a traitor. So there was a period of about 5 months during which I basically came to terms with my fear and had to resolve my fear in order to gain the strength to go public. And, you know, one good day I did. I went public. I denounced the war as illegal and criminal and oil-driven. And I said that, you know, no one in the military signed to fight this war. You know, we signed to protect and defend the Constitution and the country. We didn't sign a contract to fight for corporations, so I'm not going back. And then obviously this got huge in the news. And, you know, after that I surrendered to the military, and then 2 months later I was tried. I was found guilty of desertion, and they gave me a year in jail and demoted me from staff sergeant to private and gave me a bad conduct discharge. So I went to jail in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, served 9 months, got out 3 months earlier because of good conduct, and then I got out and I joined IVAW, and I've been an activist with Iraq Veterans Against the War since then.
Yeah, there's all this controversy in the news about torture and waterboarding and things like that. What do you think about when you hear people say things like, you know, keeping people awake, loud music, stress positions? It's not really all that bad.
Well, it's horrible. You know, it'll make a person break down completely. It's not just that you can't sleep for 3 days or whatever. You know, basically it destroys your psychological makeup. You know, your notion of time, your notion of space, every sense that you have is basically destroyed. It's not just keeping people awake. It's not like drinking coffee for 48 hours. You know, this is like they're injecting your heart with extreme fear. And this is just my experience, but, you know, we're talking about people being cornered by dogs, and we're talking about people, you know, waterboarding. We're talking about electrical shocks, you know, physical torture, beatings. It's no light issue, you know. I mean, it's real and it's bad, and, you know, we wouldn't want to be treated that way. We wouldn't want our servicemen and women to be treated that way, so why should we do it to other people?
All right, and in this last seconds that we have, what would you like to leave our audience with, Camilo?
Well, I would like to tell people that, you know, there is a movement of resistance in the military, and they can find out more about it if they go to IVAW.org. That's for Iraq Veterans Against the War.org. And to support military resistance, and if you're in the military and you're thinking about resisting this war, it's not only your right, it's your legal duty, because this is an illegitimate war, an illegitimate occupation. And if you choose to do so, you're not going to be alone. You're going to have a team of attorneys. You're going to have Iraq Veterans Against the War standing behind you. You're going to have groups like Veterans for Peace. And, you know, I encourage everyone to follow their conscience, you know, wherever that takes them.
The books, Road from Aramadi, The Private Rebellion of Staff Sergeant Camilo Mejia. It's from the New Press. You can go to thenewpress.com. I'm sure you can find it on Amazon.com, too. Camilo, thank you for being so generous with your time with us this morning.
You're welcome.
Best of luck. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right.
Wow, impressive.
Yeah.
But can you imagine what kind of fortitude it took to stand up against the military, stand up against at that time, because, I mean, he's right, public opinion was on Bush's side, and to somebody, and to go through with your commitments, your tour, and refuse to come back, it's quite impressive. People like that, you know, deserve to be listened to, and it's amazing that he said there's about 10,000 people backing him in this, and that's an
10,000 people are charged with desertion.
You know, and that's what this system is about in the U.S. The fact that these soldiers are willing to take possible imprisonment to do the right thing, and the point I make, and I hope a lot of our Republicans or pro-war listeners are really listening to this guy. You know, this was our typical soldier out there. A lot of people tend to think of this soldier like they're Rambos. You know, these, you know, America, love it or leave it. But he's just a regular person. You said earlier, social or economic issues, they go into the military. There's nothing wrong with that. That's fine. Any way you serve, you serve. And he's making, you know, this choice in life. And if our military would do this, this sends a clear message. And he said it's not that he doesn't love this country. He's not patriotic. But the fact is what we're doing was wrong. And how can we be better than somebody else if we're doing the same thing?
And the other thing is the abuse of the detainees was right at the beginning.
At the beginning. And Henry is, they were just softening him up. This was just like the first, like the intro. It's kind of like eating an appetizer, you know? Okay, soften them up. Now we're taking them. So if it was bad at the beginning when they're softening up, according to his words, how bad did it get?
Yeah, it can't
when they
just
down
be
to the nitty and gritty.
A few bad apples on the night shift. It is an institutional situation and a whole bureaucracy built around this.
And then the question is this, I know it sounds hokey, but is this what the United States stands for? Is this what we want to spread across the world?
And if we had had more time, I would have wanted to find out how racism plays into this. And looking at those people as different from yourself,
sure.
whatever your American ethnicity is as you go over.
Sure.
You're live on the air.
I speak with Mitch, please.
You're going to have to wait till Monday.
What's up, guys?
Dave, what's up, brother?
Jimmy.
How you doing?
Man, I caught the tail end of that guy. Holy smokes.
Yeah, pretty impressive, huh?
You're going to have to go back to AmericanAM.Podomatic.com and listen to
every day.
Yeah, well, listen to the beginning of the interview where he talks about the softening up the prisoners, what he had to do.
And it kind of goes with what I say all the time. You know, there's a difference between the soldiers and the bosses. The soldiers are good, regular people.
Well,
the criminals are the ones sitting in D.C. without a uniform. Those are the criminals.
We talk about waterboarding, stuff like that, but mock executions is another thing prohibited by the Geneva Conventions.
Oh, yeah. And don't
mock
forget.
Executions.
And don't forget.
Like
Henry,
I said, you got to go back and listen.
A lot of our listeners don't know this. Is we prosecuted the Japanese for war crimes, and guess what it was? It was waterboarding. We prosecuted those for doing that against our soldiers, and we're doing it against their soldiers. What makes us any different?
We are the good guys.
All right.
Much more.
We wear the white hats, right?
Much more coming up.
You've had an auto accident. You're in pain and dealing with attorneys. The last thing you want is for you to be treated just like another insurance claim form by your medical caregivers. That's why you need to know about MedFlorida Health Services. MedFlorida Health Services provides comprehensive treatment for victims of auto accidents. At MedFlorida Health Services, you can receive care from a board-certified medical doctor, a licensed massage therapist, an acupuncturist, all under one roof. Med Florida Health Services will also coordinate attorney information and file your insurance claim. When injured in an auto accident, the one name to remember is Med Florida Health Services at 373 Braden Avenue near the Sarasota Airport. Call them today at 359-9090. Don't wait. Same-day appointments available. 359-9090. That's 359-9090.
The best way to avoid an accident-related injury is to avoid the accident. Slow down, drive defensively, and please wear your seatbelt. If you've been injured in an accident, you probably have questions. How will I pay the doctors? What if I'm out of work? Who will fix my car? You may not know where to turn. You're inundated with TV and radio commercials. You may even have received letters from lawyers or doctors. At Callens Little, Delgado, and Opstal, we understand how confusing an accident can be, and we want to help answer your questions. Call us today at 941-749-1446. One of our attorneys will meet with you and help answer any questions that you have. There's no charge to meet with us, and our fees are based on a percentage of what we recover for you. I'm Scott Callens at Callens Little, Delgado, and Opstal. We work hard serving our clients and our community. Call us at 941-749-1446 and let us help answer your questions. Callens Little, Delgado, and Opstal are proud sponsors of the Manatee County YMCA. For more information, call us at 941-749-1446 or reach us at makeempay.net.
Oh, I can't face another day of pain.
You don't have to suffer in pain another day. Dr. Owen McCarthy, specializing in orthopedics and sports medicine, has been bringing relief to sufferers of arthritis, auto accidents, work-related injuries, and sports injuries for over 30 years. A board-certified physician, Dr. McCarthy will take a conservative, cautious approach to your treatment, but he will get you relief. With offices in Bradenton and Sun City Center, Dr. Owen McCarthy can treat patients anywhere in our broadcast area. Give him a call today at 941-795-3844. 941-795-3844. Accepting Medicare, most commercial insurances, and private payers. Give Dr. McCarthy a call. 941-795-3844.
Mukasey has said he finds waterboarding personally repugnant and that he might consider it torture if done to him. But on the plane flying to Baghdad, he told me that would not affect his concern of whether it is interrogation technique. Because in the context of a CIA interrogation, he said it would be used on very different people in very different circumstances. Mukasey quoted CIA Director Michael Hayden's statement that out of a large number of terrorism detainees, 100 were subjected to coercive interrogation techniques.
And of those, three were waterboarded. So these are people who self-select for their ability to resist the technique.
Congress has passed laws in the last few years that Mukasey says could relate specifically to waterboarding. The Military Commissions Act and the Detainee Treatment Act, for example. But I pointed out the President has asserted the right to ignore laws passed by Congress using his commander-in-chief powers under Article 2 of the Constitution. Mukasey said he doesn't think that's a serious threat.
The question of conflict between the President's Article 2 powers and statute is one that I think is to a large extent overblown.
Plus, he said, if the President decides to ignore a law that appears to outlaw waterboarding and authorize the technique, there are other problems.
Okay, let's assume that the President wants, despite a finding of illegality under law, to have waterboarding done. Who is it precisely that is going to get to do it? He would virtually have to do it himself.
Mukasey said the people who would ordinarily do the waterboarding, CIA interrogators, just wouldn't do it under those circumstances.
That was an excerpt from an NPR interview with Attorney General Mukasey. Yeah. Sort of hard to hear there. Those NPR guys need to realize you don't do your interviews on the side of the street. But he said if the president were to issue a signing statement, despite a finding of illegality to have waterboarding done, who is precisely going to do it? He'd virtually have to do it himself. In other words, they wouldn't cross the line on that. So,
you know, Henry, I talked about the Japanese that were tried for this. They weren't the only ones. You know, as far back as the U.S. occupation of the Philippines after the 1998 Spanish-American War in the U.S., U.S. soldiers were court-martialed for using what they called the water cure against Filipino guerrillas. And in 1983, federal prosecutors charged a Texas sheriff and three of his deputies with violating the prisoner's civil rights by forcing confessions. And guess what the technique was? It was a form of waterboarding. There's precedent for this.
Where was that?
In Texas. I know. Mm-hmm. I'm surprised they prosecuted him in Texas.
All right.
But there's precedent for this.
All right. Let's go back to the phone lines. We're going to go with Beverly first. Beverly, go ahead.
Yes, every day I call at least two in D.C., and I tell them that I want simultaneously Cheney and Bush impeached for this war, and secondly, the royalties on oil are yet unpaid, and nothing's been done about this, and I left one message especially yesterday for Ms. Pelosi. Let Mrs. Pelosi decide how she wants to look at herself. And another reason I give is that the suicides now in service match those carried out in the Vietnam War. And I feel as though it's an injustice to mankind for all this.
Okay, and backing up just a little bit, Beverly, the royalties that you're saying are going unpaid, those are what the oil companies owe to the federal government?
Yes, and some of the oil companies wanted to go along and get the past royalties paid, and nothing was done. They keep appointing a new secretary of the Department of Interior, and it's still not settled. It's still not done, and I've made so many calls about that, and that's still just overlooked. They were taken off in Bill Clinton's term. They said, they want to bring the price of oil up, and they were never reinstituted. And the problem is nothing has been done. And this war, maybe, we had to go in there. Saddam threatened that he wouldn't accept the dollars. Well, now that was the issue to be settled, not another war like his father had put on us. And that, I've said enough, I feel, Henry, but I feel as though the American people are not standing up in their own homes in battling this thing.
We need an
impeachment on the two of them. We need to right this country. This is wrong what we've been doing.
Well, you won't get an argument here, Beverly. Thank you so much for the call.
Okay.
Speaking of calling, not to minimize what Beverly said, but we only have a few more minutes for me to ask you to do this for us one more time, please. Please give the Iron Skillet Cafe a call and let them know you heard me talking about them on the radio. Their number is 761-4691. That's 761-4961. It's a 941 area code. It's just down the street from the studio here. We really need to get another sponsor on this if we're going to stay on the air. If you want to keep hearing programming like we did, they're in the process of considering us. I'd like you to let them know that we have a very loyal audience that appreciates support for our show. So give Chef Joe or Chef Nicole a call at 941-761-4961. Jim and I will be down there in just a few minutes if you want to drop by 71st Street and Cortez Road. Maybe Jim will be getting the Huevos Ranchero. Make their own homemade salsa there.
Oh, we'll see.
We also got Dave standing by, but go ahead.
All right. Getting back to this, I think people watch too much TV, and they have a feeling that interrogation is kind of like 24, where Jack Bauer gets the lamp, breaks the lamp, gets out the two little wires, and puts on the guy's testicles, and oh, yes, he confesses. It's not James Bond either. Like the bad guy says, there's a bomb that's going to the building. It's going to detonate in 30 minutes, and I'm not going to tell you a word. That's the movies. And we have to start realizing that what happens on the battlefield is not the movies. It's not this romantic James Bond, Jack Bauer type situation.
We will get to Dave. He's got a couple sports headlines for us. There's one more soundbite I wanted to play since Beverly brought up the impeachment. Of course, Congressman Wexler in South Florida has been pushing for impeachment, trying to get a petition to move Representative Conyers forward on this. But he had an interesting moment yesterday, or perhaps it was the day before, with Condoleezza Rice. It also goes back to what Beverly was saying about the false statements leading up to the war. And this is what the exchange between Robert Wexler and Condoleezza Rice.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Madam Secretary, over the past month, startling revelations have come forward that specifically relate to your conduct prior to 9/11 and in the run-up to the war in Iraq. A recently released study by the nonpartisan Center for Public Integrity revealed that you, along with President Bush, top administration officials, made a total of 935 false public statements in an orchestrated attempt to take this nation to war. Here's a stack of these false statements right here, all 935 of them. This study has found that you, Madam Secretary, made 56 false statements to the American people, where you repeatedly pump up the case that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction and exaggerate the so-called relationship between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. Madam Secretary, can you please tell us, isn't it true that you had intelligence that cast doubt on your repeated claims that Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction?
No, it's not true, Congressman. With all due respect, I think if you look back at the key judgments of the intelligence estimate about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, you will see that those judgments supported the views of many intelligence agencies worldwide.
We're not going to have time to finish all that.
Again.
Yeah, how do you tell when Condoleezza Rice is lying?
Opens her mouth.
That's right. Anyway, Dave has been standing by patiently with his sports headline.
Good morning, American AM sports fans. Liar, liar, pants on fire. Speaking of liars, one of Brian McNamee's lawyers predicted that Roger Clemens will be pardoned by President Bush, saying that some Republicans treated his client harshly because of the pitcher's relationship with the Bush family. No. Richard Emery, the attorney, made the claims Thursday, a day after a congressional hearing broke down among party lines. Many Democrats were skeptical of Clemens' denials he used performance-enhancing drugs, and Republicans questioned the character of McNamee, the personal trainer who made the accusations against the seven-time Cy Young Award winner. This is bizarre. You know, I mean, the guy lied. It nearly cost Bill Clinton his presidency. And this should never be in front of the Congress of the United States, but if the guy lied under oath, then he should suffer the penalties. Nevertheless, moving right along on a more local level, Sarasota County commissioners have voted to quickly mobilize and convince the Reds to stay in Sarasota. While
they
November rejected a narrowly rejected proposal for a $16 million property tax to fund a stadium, that was turned down, and now the Reds have entered into a 75-day exclusive negotiating period with the town of Goodyear, Arizona. It may be too little, too late. Ladies and gentlemen, we may say goodbye to spring baseball in Sarasota.
You know what's funny, Dave?
We've got to get out of here for Jay and Julie's show. I know. It's never long enough.
It's never long enough.
Oh, wait a minute. Julie is being generous with the time.
Well, no, she's just saying you got a minute.
Well, finish your comment.
Well, the issue is we're sitting here trying to prosecute Clemens for using steroids, and we got the administration lying over 800 times, and we can't get a congressional hearing for them, but we're going after steroid use because it's bad for the children because they're heroes. They're using steroids. Who the hell cares if they're using steroids? I don't care.
Right,
I care about my tax dollars paying for somebody else to die. That's what I care about. I care about the fact that they lied. I care about the fact that Condi, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and George are sitting in that White House and they're not in front of Congress swearing to tell the truth. We got
to
stop
this. Welcome to the world of absurd and silly.
That's what I'm telling you. Stop paying for my. I want my tax dollars. I'm gonna send it in.
I
do not spend any more money.
40-second commercial that has to run here. That's by the station.
That's ridiculous.
In height of absurdity, I heard Hulk Hogan being asked yesterday on the radio about Roger Clemens lying about steroid use.
Yeah, like he didn't use them himself.
University Park Jewelers in Sarasota is reminding everyone to please give blood. By doing so, you may save the life of a child, surgery patient, or an accident victim. Give blood. It's safe, it's simple, and it's needed. This important message is courtesy of Larry and Sherry and the fine staff at University Park Jewelers at 62,000 North Lockwood Ridge Road in Sarasota, where they feel our area is a great place to live and raise a family. Call University Park Jewelers at 941-351-1700. That's University Park Jewelers, serving the community with pride for over 13 years.
Life you can't take for granted. We leave this world.
Thanks to Camilo Mejia, Jim Delgado, Sarah Dave, everybody else. Stay tuned for Jay and Julie Show coming up next. Our future's